Good evening. A day before Thanksgiving, a day of mourning for indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere, especially in Bolivia. Progressives in the House vote to keep a spy bill in place and more on impeachment. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Wednesday, November 27th, 2019. Tens of thousands of residents in Texas have been ordered to flee as firefighters struggle to contain a massive blaze at a chemical plant following a series of explosions at the facility. All residents within 4 miles of the conflagration at the TPC Group chemical plant in Port Neches, which erupted early on Wednesday, were told to evacuate. Communities affected by the mandatory evacuation order include Port Neches, Netherland Groves, Boart Gardens, Central Gardens, as well as portions of Port Arthur. At least one powerful secondary explosion rocked the plant on Wednesday afternoon amid ongoing efforts to extinguish the fire, which had been burning for over 12 hours already. Collapsing, flaring stacks, the facility posed risks of additional explosions. There were up to 27 workers on the site at the time of the incident. 3 minor injuries were reported. Now, to these headlines with Linda Perry.
More than 80 groups have joined together to pressure Mayor Bill de Blasio and Governor Andrew Cuomo to cancel plans to hire 500 new MTA cops and to withdraw the 500 police officers they added to mass transit last summer. They say the surge of additional police has exacerbated conditions of hyper-aggressive policing, which criminalizes and harms Black and other New Yorkers of color every day. They wrote a letter which went to Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins and New York State Assembly Speaker Carl Hastings, as well as to the governor and mayor. It was signed by organizations representative of community members throughout the city and throughout the state. It points out that in the past few weeks alone, viral social media videos have shown officers punch Black children, draw guns towards crowded train cars, and arrest immigrant food vendors and candy sellers for trying to make a living. While not captured on viral videos, people who are homeless and have paid their fare continue to be harassed by officers in the transit system, and they are scapegoated. Instead of more police in our transit system, the groups say what's needed is to fix the subway system and end broken windows policing and also end the false narrative of rising crime. In other news, New York City lawmakers voted 42-2 on Tuesday to ban flavored electronic cigarettes after a lawsuit halted a statewide ban. The measure, which Bill de Blasio said he supports, bans all e-cigarettes and e-liquid flavors except tobacco. It's expected to take effect on July 1st, 2020. Cheryl Richter, executive director of the New York State Vapor Association, said her group represents hundreds of thousands of consumers who rely on vapor products to keep them from smoking cigarettes in New York. She called the New York City bill an overreaching infringement of their constitutional right to choose a product that improves their health. The move to ban flavored e-cigarettes comes amid nationwide concern about the growth of teenage vaping and fears about health risks. New York City Councilmember Mark Levine said, "We are acting to protect our kids by banning the e-cigarette flavors that have been hooking them for years." A ban on the sale of menthol cigarettes was omitted from the New York City legislation after lobbying by advocates, including Al Sharpton, who argued that a ban on menthol cigarettes could lead to harsh police enforcement in the Black community. In other news, a new report by Make the Road New York and New York Communities for Change highlights danger for Amazon workers. It shows that Staten Island workers are injured more often than coal miners, waste collection workers, and other laborers. The report shows that while Amazon continues to speed up delivery to customers, it's done at the expense of worker safety. The Staten Island Fulfillment Center has seen an incident rate 3 times higher than similar warehouse workers. And now a new campaign, it's called We Are Athena, is bringing together grassroots organizations to rein in Amazon's abuse of workers. This week, workers held signs saying Amazon hurts workers outside the Staten Island facility. They delivered a petition meant for Amazon's Jeff Bezos. It demands longer work breaks and more dedicated MTA buses to the far-flung facility, and it protests the rate of injury at the warehouse. In addition, activists say tech giants like Amazon must must be held accountable for serving as the tech backbone of ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement. ICE being the arm of the Trump administration, which deported over 250,000 people just last year. The activists say companies like Amazon that choose to work with ICE are complicit in the death and suffering that ICE creates. Check out the hashtag WeAreAthena on social media. Meanwhile, the digital rights organization Fight for the Future is calling for an investigation into Amazon. They say that Facebook has actively blocked its users from sharing a link to a web page critical of Amazon. It labels its internet-connected home security products a threat to privacy, civil liberty, and security. The site, which is blocked, reveals Amazon's close partnerships with more than 600 police agencies across the U.S. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
Thanks, Linda. And United American Indians of New England has held a solemn remembrance on every Thanksgiving Day since 1970 to recall what organizers describe as the genocide of millions of Native people, the theft of Native lands, and the relentless assault on Native culture. Their message, Happy Thanksgiving to you in the land your forefathers stole. But Thursday's gathering will have particular resonance, and Indigenous people say a fresh sense of urgency. Plymouth is putting the final touches on next year's 400th anniversary commemorations of the Pilgrims' Landing in 1620. And as the 2020 events approach, descendants of the Wampanoag tribe that helped the newcomers survive are determined to ensure the world doesn't forget the disease, racism, and oppression the European settlers brought. As they have on every Thanksgiving for the past half century, participants will assemble at noon on Coles Hill, a windswept mound overlooking Plymouth Rock, a memorial to the colonists' arrival. Beneath a giant bronze statue of Massasoit, the Wampanoag leader in 1620, Native Americans from tribes around New England will beat drums, offer prayers, and read speeches before marching through Plymouth's historic district, joined by dozens of sympathetic supporters. Organizers say they'll also call attention to the plight of missing and murdered Indigenous women, as well as government crackdowns on migrants from Latin America and the detentions of children. Promotional posters proclaim, "We didn't cross the border. The border crossed us." And in Bolivia, recently enduring a coup brought by a right-wing evangelical Christian against a government that had the broad support of Bolivia's native people. Code Pink activist and WBAI host Medea Benjamin just got back from the South American nation, where she says she saw evidence of murder and other human rights violations against that nation's millions of Indigenous citizens.
While many people in this country are celebrating Thanksgiving, it's of course a time to think about Indigenous people. And the Indigenous people in Bolivia are suffering from a terrible blow, having lost their leader for 13 years, who had really made the lives of Bolivian people so much better and lifted up the voices of the Indigenous people, to suddenly being the victims of a racist coup that does not respect the traditions and customs of the Indigenous people, that has used the military to murder and maim Indigenous people, and wants to roll back so many of the gains made in these last 13 years.
And what did you see there as far as the people's reaction in the streets to this new government? And what was the effect of this new government on the people there?
The people hate the new government, in part because of this lack of respect for Indigenous customs, the burning of the Indigenous flag, the Wipala, the massacres that have taken place both outside Cochabamba and outside La Paz in the city of El Alto, the rounding up of hundreds and hundreds of Indigenous people and throwing them into jail, and the fear that is spread among the community of people who are leaders, organizers, who many of whom are now living underground, afraid that they're going to be picked up. And the sense is that this is a government that is taking revenge on the Indigenous community for 13 years of the power that they held, and that wants to bring the white European descendants back into the palace of the president, that wants to reverse so many of the gains of having Indigenous people in so many of the ministries. This new government, when it first named the new ministers, didn't even have one indigenous person until there was an outcry, and then they said, oh, okay, we'll give the Ministry of Culture to an indigenous person. So the cries in the demonstrations are that the President Jeanine Añez has to go, that this coup has to go, and there is certainly an aura of fear as well as anger.
Code Pink's Medea Benjamin. The election results sparked weeks of protests, culminating in President Evo Morales being forced out. Parts of the country have been crippled by violent protests since then. At least 29 people have been killed in clashes between security forces and protesters. During Morales' time in power, the country's relationship with the U.S. was tense. In 2008, under former U.S. President George W. Bush, ambassadors from both countries were expelled. Right-wing Senator Jeanine Añez declared herself interim president shortly after Morales' resignation and was formally recognized by the U.S. She immediately began reversing the socialist ex-leader's policies. She broke diplomatic ties with the socialist governments of Cuba and Venezuela, which were previously two of Bolivia's closest allies in the region. Añez also formally recognized Venezuela's opposition leader, Juan Guaido, as the country's president rather than President Nicolas Maduro. All of Bolivia's ambassadors were dismissed, except for those to the Vatican and Peru. Earlier today, the special envoy for the United States to Venezuela, Elliot Abrams, a right-wing hawk, spoke at a State Department news conference. He accused Venezuela, the Colombian rebels known as FARC, and Cuba of interfering.
I wanted to ask you, Ambassador Abrams, about a recent meeting that was held, according to the Venezuelan opposition, of some leaders of FARC, the dissident part of FARC, and some Chilean opposition leaders, with the idea of keeping alive the ideas of the Foro of Sao Paulo and creating unrest, political unrest within the continent. This question would be framed in the major problems of digital interference in this crisis. And if you think that Venezuela may be a factor, not of the discontent, but of aggravating crisis with interference. You know, like close to 30 Venezuelans were expelled from Colombia recently. So I wanted to know your opinion on that.
I don't know about that particular meeting. It's clear from the public record that Cuba and Venezuela did a lot of broadcasting, tweeting, speaking, in an effort to exacerbate the problems that have existed in the last, let's say, a month or so, in a number of South American countries. That's obvious. And there is some evidence. You cite, for example, the expulsions. We know of other cases where people were arrested. There was a case in Bolivia with $100,000 in cash, Cubans. So there is evidence beginning to build of an effort by the regimes in Cuba and Venezuela to exacerbate problems in South America.
Yellow tie? Sorry, I don't know your name.
Ambassador Jorge from Voice of America Spanish. My question is there a change in the U.S. policy on Venezuela? And I ask this because it's been like a lot of months, without having these briefings here to talk on about Venezuela. If so or no, what is next in the policy?
There's no change. There's no change, and there is no change not only in policy, but in the level of very intense interest on the part of the president and the vice president and the secretary of state. What is next is, I would say, a continuation of the current policy. We think we have the right policy. We think we are confident we have the support of the Venezuelan people. You saw it when hundreds of thousands of them went to the streets on November 16th to protest against the regime that's in power and to demand change. So the policy that you see, economic pressure, diplomatic pressure, an effort to get more and more countries in this region and in Europe to join in these efforts to restore democracy to Venezuela, that policy will continue.
Medea Benjamin responds.
Well, the Bolivian government just kicked out over 700 Cuban medical workers who were there out in the countryside giving health care to people who never had it before. So I don't know that Elliot Abrams understands that the Cubans there have been saving lives. And the Venezuelans have been supporting with all kinds of programs that have helped the Venezuelan people, and the coalition of the different progressive governments called ALBA has been very good for the Bolivian people. That's why they're trying to now, with this new coup government, destroy the reputations of Venezuela and Cuba, and put them on television rounding up just ordinary people from those countries and saying that they're the leaders who are trying to spread terrorism, that it's the Venezuelan government and the Cuban government that are behind the protests, and nothing could be further from the truth.
How about the other way around? How about the United States and some of these other right-wing countries and expatriate groups? Are they to be seen in Bolivia?
Some of the immediate things that this coup government did was reach out to the right-wing government of Brazil and of Colombia and other people in power and in other Latin American countries, and really show that they're part of this Christian fundamentalist racist right wing that unfortunately has taken over in many countries. But let's also remember that in many countries there is opposition, like the huge marches out in the streets in Chile, in Ecuador, and that there are, as we speak, indigenous groups in other countries that are organizing delegations to go to Bolivia and show their solidarity.
If you were in front of Elliot Abrams, like the squad had that opportunity to call him out as a war criminal, what would you have to say to him?
The best thing he could do for Latin America was to disappear from the scene, to certainly stay out of the internal affairs of other countries. And I think we should also let your listeners know that it's very disturbing that there is a law now that has been approved by the legislature in Bolivia, along with the president de facto, that is setting the stage for elections. But it's hard to imagine that there will be free and fair elections in Bolivia. And certainly Elliot Abrams will want to have his hand in the mix and make sure that the pro-U.S. faction is going to win that. So we have to stay tuned and do what we can to keep our government out of Bolivia and to give solidarity to the indigenous and other poor people who have benefited so much from 13 years of the rule of Evo Morales.
Code Pink activist and WBAI host Medea Benjamin. In national news, oh, by the way, you're listening to the WBAI Evening News. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In national news, privacy activists say it was a major capitulation by the House Progressive Caucus, whose leading members joined other self-described progressives in supporting authorization or reauthorization of Section 215 of the Patriot Act. That was exposed by On the Lam whistleblower Edward Snowden, the section of the law that allows the FBI to obtain the records of virtually every phone call made in the U.S. It was due to expire in December. The executive director of Defending Rights and Dissent, Sue Udre, says the caucus could have demanded serious reforms or forced the law to sunset. Instead, they gave in.
The most expansive surveillance provisions in the Patriot Act, which are known as Section 215, they were enacted into law with a sunset. And so over the past 20 years since the Patriot Act was passed, every few years the law is revisited to see if it's necessary and see if it's working the way they expected it to, just to force Congress to look at the issue every 3 or 4 years.
What is the Patriot Act?
The Patriot Act itself is a huge law that was enacted after 9/11 to give intelligence agencies all the powers and authorities they needed to be able to go after Al-Qaeda. It actually gave the intelligence community a lot more authority and power than they needed. And one of the main provisions that we've been most concerned about is this provision, Section 215, that was set to expire on December 15th.
And that was something that Edward Snowden mentioned in particular.
the thing that got us all riled up originally about Section 215, it was we called it the Library Records Act, and we were concerned that it gave the government the authority to get business records without a warrant. They were going to be able to go find out all the books we'd been taking out or videos we'd been taking out of the library. And then Ed Snowden came along and showed us that it was way worse than we ever imagined. And the primary thing, the very first thing that we learned from the documents that he released was that the NSA had been collecting virtually every single phone call in America for years. So that's a program known as the Call Detail Records Program, and we've been fighting a lot about that since the Snowden revelations and got some reforms a few years ago, but they turned out not to be nearly enough.
So this comes before Congress, and it passes, with the votes of some very progressive members, doesn't it?
So this is what's so frustrating, is advocates have been working for years with an eye toward this renewal or sunset of Section 215, educating members of Congress about the way the law is being used and misused. And so the Progressive Caucus actually had joined with the Freedom Caucus earlier this fall to send a letter to the chairs of the two committees, the House Intelligence and the House Judiciary Committee, that are going to be, you have jurisdiction over this bill. And they basically said, we think the law should sunset unless these about six reforms are included in any renewal of Section 215. They admitted that the law has facilitated unconstitutional mass surveillance. We all know it was recently uncovered that the FBI has been actively avoiding complying with the law.
The FBI is not complying. What should the FBI be doing that it's not complying with?
One of our main concerns about this law is what's called the FBI's backdoor search. So the NSA collects all this data about our phone calls, and the FBI kind of searches through that data without a warrant to see who's talking to who. So we know through a recently published FISA court ruling that the FBI had been taking liberties with searching through all this data and trying to cover their tracks. So the Progressive Caucus and the Freedom Caucus and many other members of Congress recognize that there's these huge problems with the law and with the way the FBI and the NSA are treating the law. The Progressive Caucus and Freedom Caucus sent a letter to the chairs of the two committees and said, I quote, disclosures over the past several years make clear that existing expansive surveillance powers pose an unacceptable threat to civil rights and civil liberties. So the Progressive Caucus believes that this law is an unacceptable threat to our civil rights and civil liberties, and yet they signed on to allow it to continue for another 3 months.
And who voted for it? That was a big surprise.
I'll tell you, not to cast blame, I was surprised and disappointed that the chair of the Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal, voted for it. She actually used to serve on our board of directors. So I was disappointed that she didn't grab her power and use it. I respect her, and I imagine that she has in her mind how the process should go to get the reforms that she knows are necessary to make this law not unconstitutional. But I'm disappointed that she is choosing to not use her power to force a sunset of this law.
So when do they decide on the whole thing?
It's now set to sunset on March 15th. We'll be certainly raising this issue all through the spring.
Does it start with the Judiciary Committee?
In the House, it can start with either the Judiciary or the Intelligence Committee. We'd prefer it to be in Judiciary because they tend to have a little bit more respect for the Constitution than the Intelligence Committee.
Then Adam Schiff?
Than Adam Schiff. He's just generally not your Constitution advocate.
Anything you'd like to add?
Folks should just keep a watch on this, because I think that mass surveillance really cuts across all the issues that progressives care about, and so it's something that should be on everybody's radar.
Sue Udrey is Executive Director of Defending Rights and Dissent. Among the bright spots in the vote, members of the Squad, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan all voted against reauthorization section of Section 215. In March, the entire Patriot Act will again be up for reauthorization. And finally, the U.S. House of Representatives Judiciary Committee on Tuesday invited President Donald Trump to its first impeachment hearing, scheduled for December 4th, starting a new phase of the inquiry that could lead to formal charges against the president within weeks. James Henry is an investigative economist and lawyer who has written widely about offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking. He's been following Trump's business interests for years. He says the big picture says Trump should be impeached.
The important point is not to get swept away with these hearings, which are focused on a very kind of a narrow phone call in July. It is to look at the broader canvas here. And I think the overwhelming weight of the evidence here is that this president deserves to be impeached. Whether the Senate will actually convict him is a political question, but you know, he has committed innumerable abuses of power.
How have the revelations that have come out in the past few months dovetailed with your own research in looking into Trump's connections to Russia?
I was looking at Giuliani before this latest thing. You know, oddly enough, as of July 24th, let's say, Trump was winning. Mueller had delivered a very long, but ultimately somewhat inconclusive report after 22 months of study. The public opinion in the U.S. did not support an impeachment inquiry. I think it was at most 40% that were persuaded. And in Congress, you only had about 150 Democrats out of 230 that were supporting impeachment even then. So this was a game that Trump was winning. What's changed since that is we have the president of the United States basically injecting, asking for another foreign intervention in a U.S. election 2 years after he got away with the Russian assistance. It wasn't collusion. You didn't require collusion to have the Russians hack the DNC and turn over the data to WikiLeaks. That didn't require a lot of careful coordination. Mueller wasn't able to prove that. But in this case, you have the president of the United States doing the colluding. I mean, he's basically telling the Ukrainian president, I want you to investigate these guys, and they're my political opponents and my former political opponent. And at the time, they say the Ukrainian president didn't know the aid was cut off and it was turned back on as of September 11th. No harm, no foul. The only reason it was turned on again was because of the whistleblower. And the White House suddenly woke up and the lawyers started getting worried. They said, you can't condition U.S. foreign policy on private assistance to your electoral campaign. I mean, that's an impeachable offense. It's a form of bribery, as Pelosi said yesterday. Mm-hmm. This is largely of Trump's own making, and the fact that he ignored Senator Gregg's advice, which is, you know, don't hire Rudy Giuliani.
Who's more corrupt in this? Because some say, I've talked to some people who say, you know, the Democrats are just as corrupt. Burisma is just as corrupt. It's just that everybody is corrupt.
This is nonsense. It is the case that it was bad judgment for Hunter Biden, who basically know nothing about Ukraine or the natural gas industry in particular, to sit on that guy's board at a time when the company was under investigation. Was there anything illegal about that? No. But it was certainly, you know, improper. Did Vice President Biden get an investigation of that company killed? No, he was killed by the prosecutor that we got fired because he was corrupt. So the more you know about the details of this, you know that the Republicans are running scared. They are trying to put up a smoke screen of all these facts. And I think, yes, the corruption that exists in the Ukraine is something the United States in general has a lot of responsibility for.
And James Henry is an investigative economist and lawyer. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, November 27th, 2019. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From the studios.